Luke chapter 23, verse 42. This is part five in our Ghost Stories in the Bible series. This is one of the ones that I think some of you have been waiting for. Maybe one or two of you have. Luke 23:42. You all know the story. While Jesus was on the cross, there were two thieves, one on either side. And to one of the thieves, he said, what did he say? Well, the thief asked Jesus, or had a request, I guess. Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And what did Jesus say to him? Okay. Now, depending on how you interpret this verse, it can mean two entirely different things. And unfortunately, this is given as one of the proofs that people continue to live after they die. Now, I want you to look at the translation up there on the screen. That's from the New King James Version. Of course, the highlighting and the colorful stuff is my additions. But let me read the verse. It says, then he said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said to him, assuredly, I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. That's the New King James Version. Now, if that translation is correct, which it's not, and I'll explain to you why in a little while. But if that translation is correct, then Jesus was telling the thief that both he and the thief would continue to be alive after they died, because they were both in the process of dying, right? And that both of them would be at a place called paradise on that very day. So it's important that we understand the correct translation of the verse. So let's look at another translation. What I'm going to show you now is my translation of the very same verse from the very same Greek text that the New King James has translated from. Look how I have it. And he said to Jesus, remember me, Master, whenever you should come into your kingdom. And Jesus said to him, truly I am saying to you today, you will be with me in the garden, actually. Now, what is the major difference there? I know I have garden instead of paradise, but besides that, what is the major difference in that sentence? Okay, so I heard something over here first. All right, now I have changed where today is located.
Placement of the comma.
But I have changed where the comma is in relation to the word today. Okay? Now look at the previous one. It says, I say unto you, comma, today you will be with me in paradise. In my translation, it says, truly I am saying to you today, comma, you will be with me in paradise.
Yes, same instead of say, and then the comma changes.
It has to do with which phrase today is modified.
That's exactly right. Now, today, the word today is an adverb. And what do adverbs do?
Modify a verb.
They modify a verb, right? They modify a action word or a state of being verb. Now, the problem is, in this sentence, there are two possible verbs that today could modify. All right? It could modify I am saying, which is translated from one verb into Greek. It could modify that. In other words, saying, I'm saying this today. Or it could modify, be with me, be with. All right? That's a state of being verb. It could modify that verb. So the question is, does today, the adverb today, modify the verb that just came before it, or the verb that comes immediately after it? And that's the question. Now, the thing you have to understand is, in the Greek grammar of that verse, There is no comma, okay? There's no comma. And it's perfectly legitimate to assume that today is modifying I am saying to you just as much as it is modifying be with me. All right? You guys see what I'm saying? In other words, where we put the comma is entirely up to the translator It's not, there's nothing in the grammar, in the Greek grammar of this verse, that tells us where to place that comma. We put the comma there in English so that in the English language, it'll let us know whether today goes with the phrase before it or whether today goes with the phrase after it, all right? We add that. The translators add that, but that's not in the Greek text. So just looking at that statement alone, the Greek is completely unclear as to whether the comma should be before or after today when we translate into English, all right? That's the first point that you need to understand. So we have to have a way to decide. Now, you know, when Jesus wouldn't make a statement that was so unclear and so ambiguous that it could be interpreted two different ways, there must be another way to determine whether Jesus meant, I'm saying this to you today, that is, he's emphasizing the fact of him making the statement on that day, or whether Jesus meant to emphasize the fact that on that very day they would be someplace else. All right? So there needs to be a way of determining that, and that's what we want to look at today. The first thing you must understand, and this is very important as you understand this, is that there's no way to determine that from the grammar. Okay, from the Greek grammar. There's no way to determine it. Either translation is perfectly grammatically correct in Greek. So we need to look for other clues as to what Jesus meant by it. But by that one fact, the fact that the grammar doesn't require either one of those, and it can be translated either way, doesn't that completely undermine the use of this verse to prove that people are still alive after they're dead? Because it doesn't actually prove it. See, in order for it to prove it, the comma would have to come after I say unto you, or I say to you. If the comma must be there, then this verse would prove that both Jesus and the thief, their ghosts would continue living somewhere, paradise, after they died on that very same day, right? But because the grammar does not require that in any way, and it doesn't, the grammar itself doesn't really favor either one of those interpretations. Both of them are perfectly fine in Greek grammar, all right? So that alone takes this passage away as being proof that, that people continue to live after they die. But what I want to show you as we continue down through the points that I have is that the weight of evidence as to why it ought to be interpreted the way that I have it translated is very weighty. There's a lot of reasons why we ought to translate it the way I have as opposed to the other way. Now, let me ask you this. If you have two translators, two different translators, they don't know each other. They both are very well skilled in Greek and in English. And they want to translate this verse from Greek to English. If one translator believes in ghosts. If one translator believes that when you die, your ghost continues to live, that is, he believes in the, quote, immortality of the soul, and that people never actually do die, just their body dies, but they leave their body and they continue to live, and they go someplace. If he already believes that, where is he likely to put the comma?
What's presupposition come to put it before the today?
Sure, because he thinks, because this is what he already believes, that the Bible agrees with what he already believes, and so therefore if he puts a comma there, the text is consistent with what he already believes. But if you have another translator who is equally skilled in Greek and English, and he believes that when a person dies, they sleep, as the scripture says. They don't go anywhere. They're in their grave until the time of the resurrection. He doesn't believe in ghosts. He doesn't believe in, quote, the immortality of the soul. All right? That's what he believes. When he looks at the Greek text of this verse, where is he going to put the comma? After today. Because it makes more sense with what he believes. And again, both translations are perfectly appropriate in Greek. All right. So now what we want to do is we want to look at the logic, what I would say is the logic why it ought to be interpreted the way that I have it translated. Okay. And there are quite a few reasons, first of all. Now, what we want to do is we want to look at similarities of style. Because we can't go by rules of grammar, to determine which of these it is. See, rules of grammar are pretty fixed, right? They have a lot of weight to them. I mean, if a rule of grammar required that the comma goes there, it has to go there, whether you like it or not, right? But what we want to do now, since we can't go by that, what we wanted to go by is style. That is Jesus' normal manner of speaking. All right, Jesus frequently said, "I say unto you," and then said something. Okay, he said it quite a few times. Now, there are three other passages in the Gospels where Jesus used that kind of a phrase, I am saying to you, and then he followed it with the word today. All right? So I want to look at those three passages. If you, I have them, actually, it's on your paper. You don't have to turn there, but you can if you want to. We're on number two, style, A, number one. Mark 14:30. And it says CLV there. That's the Concordant Literal Version. That's a version that I particularly like because it's very, very literal to the Greek. But this is the translation of it. Jesus said to him, "Assuredly I say to you," now that's the exact same phrase that we have in the other verse, all right? "That today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." Jesus said that to Peter, all right? Now notice you have that introductory phrase, "I am saying to you." Jesus is saying this to Peter. He says, "Peter, I am saying to you," or "I'm telling you." And then he uses the word "today." And what did he connect it with? Did he connect it with "I am saying," or did he connect it with the verb that comes after it? The verb that comes after it. But I want you to notice something. That little word "that," which is in red print. You see that? In Greek, it's hati. He doesn't simply say, "I am saying to you today, you will deny me three times." He says, "I am saying to you that today, you will deny me three times." Now, what does the word "that" do in that sentence for us with regard to the word "today" as to where it goes?
It makes it specific.
Yeah, how does it make it specific? Yes.
Right now, it's a present.
All right. A sentence that has... Jesus says, "I'm saying to you," and then he says something to you. There's two different parts here. That sentence is divided in two different ways, right? The first part of it is Jesus simply saying what he's going to do, and the second part of it is him doing what he said he was going to do. Isn't that right? "I'm saying to you" means "I'm going to tell you something." Isn't that right? And then it's followed by whatever he was going to tell him. You guys get that, right? You see the division in the sentence. He's telling him he's going to tell him, and then he tells him. Now, the word "that" in that sentence, what does it do with regard to how that sentence is divided?
Separates the proclamation that he will tell him from what he is going to tell him.
That's exactly right. The word "that" implies whatever comes after it is part of the declaration that I'm going to give you. If I say, well, I can't really say it any better than Jesus did. "I am telling you, Peter, that today you're going to deny me," right? So "that" means, what follows "that" means, this is what I'm telling you. This is what I'm going to tell you. So the word "today," the word "hati" or "that" in this verse forces us to take the word "today," which follows it, and attach it to the clause that comes after it. It cannot be attached to the clause that comes before it, because that forces the word "today" into the latter part of the verse. Do you guys understand that? Does that make sense to you? All right, let's look at the next verse. Luke 4:21. You can just, it's printed out on your paper there. "Now he begins to be saying to them, comma, that today this scripture is fulfilled in your ears." Now, we have exactly the same situation here. Luke says Jesus is saying something, and then he quotes what Jesus said. So he's dividing the sentence into sort of editorial comments about what Jesus is doing, just like Jesus did, right? Jesus is saying something. He's telling us that. And then he tells us what Jesus said. Now, again, we have the word "that" or "hati," which forces the word "today" to be connected to the to the phrase that comes after it. All right? The third one, and by the way, these are the only three verses in the Gospels that use that saying, you know, I'm saying or he was saying, followed by what they said, that has the word today being introduced there, okay? Or any kind of an adverb, or tomorrow, or anything like that, any kind of an adverb. Yes?
So what you're showing here is not just only the style in which Jesus uses to show the same style he did with the thief on the cross, but we're showing grammatically on these particular ones, there's no way to divide it. It's simply very emphatically that it's what, only one interpretation.
Yeah, what I'm saying is, these verses that we're looking at, the only other places where we have the same kind of thing, where we have Jesus or, you know, the gospel writer telling us that Jesus said something followed by what he said, all right? These are the only verses, these three plus the one that we're examining in Luke 23. These are the only examples that we have to compare it to, okay, where that word today is included. Now, what I'm saying is, all three of the other examples, the word that, or hati in Greek, tells us absolutely that the word today must be connected to the phrase that comes after it. All right, let's look at the next one. He says, now Jesus said to him that today salvation is come to this house, or this home. Again, this was to Nicodemus. Jesus said to him, there you have the expression of what he was doing divided from what he actually said. That he's saying it, we're told that he's saying it, and then what he actually said, those two things are separated by the word hati, or that. All right, now, if we have four examples in the Gospels, and on three of those examples, we have the word hati before the word today, which forces today to modify the phrase that comes after it. The exception is the one we're looking at. It doesn't have the word hati in the phrase at all, or the word that. It's not in the phrase. Now, if including that word forces you to attach today to what comes after it, what would leaving that word out imply?
With the first part.
It could imply that. What it could imply is that normally, if you leave it out, it goes to the it modifies the first phrase. But if you put it in, it must modify the second phrase. All right. That to me that makes perfect sense. In fact, there are Greek scholars who argue that very point. All right. This is not something that I made up. This is one of their arguments. All right, here's another thing you should understand. The word today, even when it's not used by Jesus, just when it's modifying a verb anywhere in the New Testament, all right, the same Greek word, the vast majority of times it modifies the phrase that comes before it, not the phrase that comes after it. Now, there are some occasions when it does modify the phrase that comes after it, but they are fairly rare. All right? Most of the time, it modifies the one that comes before it. So, if you're just going to go on that alone, on looking at all the times that that word appears and whether it's modifying a preceding verb or a verb after it, the weight of the evidence is in favor of the way that I have translated it. All right? For both of those two reasons. Now, I want to talk about, what does the addition of the word today, I mean, couldn't Jesus say exactly the same thing and not even use the word today? See, every word that Jesus spoke had a purpose and had a reason. And it added something to what he was saying. All right? Jesus did not just throw extra words out there, just pack his sentence, you know, for verbiage. And here he is, dying on a cross, and the thief is dying on a cross, he's probably not out there with his thesaurus and looking up a lot of extra verbiage. He just had something to say to this guy. They're in a desperate situation, right? Both of them.
When people are, and I'm not speaking from experience, but when people are crucified, they tend to suffocate.
Yes, it's very hard to speak.
To speak, you're not going to waste words.
Okay. So, that being the case, Let's look at it from the perspective of what does adding the word today add to the statement at all if we translate it either way. All right, now, first of all, I want to look at it from the translation that I have given you. All right, my translation. What does the word today, what is the importance of Jesus even using the word today if you translate it the way that I have it translated? Now, let me read it to you again. And he said to Jesus, "Remember me, Master, when you should come into your kingdom." And Jesus said to him, "Truly, I am saying to you today." In other words, he's emphasizing the fact that I'm telling you this now. Okay? "You will be with me in paradise," or in the garden. So, if I've translated it properly, then Jesus used the word today for a very specific reason. Because he wanted to emphasize to the thief that what he was telling him was today. Now, I want you to think in your mind, what reason could there be? You got to understand the whole picture. You got a thief who's dying. Does that thief know he's dying today?
Yes.
Yeah, he's not going to survive the day, right? He knows he's dying today. So Jesus wasn't helping him know that you're going to die today, right? He knew that. All right. Why would it be important to the thief, from Jesus' perspective, that he know today, while he is still alive, that he's going to be with Jesus in the resurrection? Why would it be important for him to know that today, as opposed to finding out some other time? Go ahead, Kath. To ease his mind. Okay, but wouldn't it ease his mind if Jesus left out the word today? If he was simply telling him that he was going to make it. Let me ask you this. What did the thief say to Jesus that elicited this response from Jesus? He said, "Master," or "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." What does that statement acknowledge about the thief himself? This is a guy who was being executed capital punishment, right? He had committed crimes and he was being killed for his crimes. So he was a bad, bad man. But he made an acknowledgement to Jesus. He acknowledged that Jesus is the Messiah. That's what he did. Because it's the Messiah who receives the kingdom. And so if he says, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom," he is acknowledging that Jesus is the Messiah of Israel that was promised all through the scriptures. And what else is it about the Messiah that's important? Go ahead, Walter.
Well, he's also acknowledging the kingdom, and the Jews knew that the Messiah would come to reign upon the earth in his kingdom at that point in time. So I'm thinking that there's no way the thief would possibly think he's going to fly somewhere and be in some heavenly place.
Well, we're going to get to the whole in your kingdom thing in a minute, and where that is and all that kind of stuff. We'll get to that. All right. But right now, what I'm trying to get you guys to see is why Jesus would emphasize the word today, that he's making this declaration to him today. All right. Now, if Jesus is the Messiah, which it's very clear that the thief understood that because he was going to come into his kingdom. If Jesus is the Messiah, Jesus is the judge. Because the Messiah, what the Messiah does in the kingdom is judge. He's the judge, right? Not only that, at the last judgment, when the dead stand before God, even the wicked, and they stand before God, who is it that determines their eternal destiny? Jesus does. The Bible is very clear about that, all right? In fact, in Paul's sermon in Athens, he talked about that God is going to judge all by that man whom he has appointed, Jesus Christ. And he says he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. All right, so Christ is the judge ultimately in the end. Now, the thief understood this from the Old Testament scriptures. He understood that the one hanging on the cross next to him was the judge who on the last day, the day of the judgment, he was going to stand before, and his eternal destiny, whether he's going to be thrown into the fire or whether he's going to have an inheritance in the kingdom, that Jesus is the guy who's going to make that judgment. Isn't that right? Now, for the thief, dying, Walter gets it. He's nodding his head over there. For the thief who is dying, and he doesn't know if he's going to burn in the flames or if he is going to have an inheritance in the kingdom of God, he has no idea. He's thinking, you know what? It's not looking too good for me. Right? That's what he's thinking. The judge is next to me. I'm being killed for my crimes. He's innocent. It's not looking good for me. And so he turns to the judge and he says, Lord, sort of a request that maybe at the judgment, he might remember that Jesus, that he acknowledged him as the Messiah. And so what does Jesus do? He comforts him. Because what he did was he made his judgment while he was on the cross about that thief, instead of waiting until the day of judgment to make that determination. He did it on that day. He did it on the day that the thief was dying. And why did he do it? So the guy could die in peace. That's why he did it. It was an act of love. You see that?
That's an aha moment right there. That's, never really considered that before like that. And then he looked at the consideration before too, when these were arguing back before, he said, this man is innocent.
Yes. He acknowledged that he was innocent.
And he said, we're guilty.
Yes.
So he confessed his sins, acknowledged he was the Messiah.
He confessed his sin, he repented of his sin, and he acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah. The only thing he didn't do was get baptized, but that's not possible while you're hanging on a cross. Yeah. All right. What Jesus did was let him know his verdict before the man died. And that's why the word today is so important, that Jesus was telling him, look, I'm telling you this today. I'm not waiting until, you know, you're brought back for the resurrection, and you're standing before me when all people are shaking in fear in front of me. Here I am hanging on a cross and I'm dying. I'm making my verdict right now. That's what he was saying. All right? I'm telling you today. And what did he tell him today on that very day? You will be with me in the garden. Now, we'll get to what that means in a few moments. Now, I want you to... Well, the word today is adding emphasis. All right, that's all it's doing. It still would mean essentially the same thing without the word today, but by emphasizing it, it gives comfort to the thief. All right, it's the emphasis. The word today adds emphasis to either one of those two phrases. All right, does that make sense to you? I'm telling you this right now. Now, if I say to you, I'm telling you, you can have $100. That means one thing. I'm telling you some facts. If I say, I'm telling you right now, you can have $100. What does that tell you? Come and get it. Right? Okay. Jesus is not saying, I'm telling you that, you know, in the kingdom or at the judgment, I'll pass my verdict this way. It's not what he's saying. He's saying, I'm passing my verdict right now. See, it adds a something that to that thief was like, given a glass of cold water to a guy out, you know, dehydrated in the desert. For him, that's what that little word meant to him, okay? It's very, very important to him. It was important. And Jesus didn't say it for our benefit. He said it for his benefit, because Jesus was merciful even on the cross to that dying thief. Now, what about the word today? If we translate the verse the way it's translated in your New King James Version, that is, you're going to be with me in paradise today. That is, he's telling them that's where we're going today. Okay, we're going to paradise and we're going there today. What does that add to what Jesus was saying? Was there any question that they were dying that day? No, there was no question about that. What does it add?
If you're saying it that way, it's telling him he's going to fly off somewhere. If you're saying today you're going to be in paradise, mm-hmm. I mean, he has a ghost, and he would.
Well, let's assume that both that let's assume that the that both that Jesus taught that people have ghosts. Let's assume that the thief believed that people have ghosts. Okay? Let's assume that they believe that. I'm assuming they did not believe that. I'm assuming Jesus didn't teach that, and I'm assuming that that was the farthest thing from the thief's mind. If we assume that Jesus did teach that, and we assume, obviously, then, that the thief probably believed that as well, and if the translator assumes it as well, all right, what does the word today add? What is the significance of the word today? They both, see, the thing is they already knew, or the thief already knew he was dying that day. So by saying today, he's not adding any new information to him. You know, I mean, if the thief believed that when you die, your ghost floats away to paradise, and paradise is the ghost lounge. If the thief believed that, if that's what people believed, then adding today doesn't add anything at all to the statement. It's completely redundant. That's the point that I'm trying to make. All right, it doesn't really add anything of any significance. Okay, now we need to talk about paradise, because this is where the absolute final determination comes from, that word paradise, as to how this verse should be translated. Let me ask you guys, what is paradise?
It's like the Garden of Eden. It's when the kingdom is here.
Well, if that's what it is, then it's here on earth and it's physical. Therefore, it's not a place for ghosts. Now, see, people have this idea that somewhere out there, there is a storehouse for ghosts to wait until the resurrection, while they're conscious and alive and all that. Some people, so if you ask them that, well, where is that? Oh, for the righteous. Oh, that's Abraham's bosom. You ever hear that one? We talked about the rich man Lazarus last time, Abraham's bosom. Is Abraham's bosom a place? Is my bosom a place? Is your chest a place? Is there a place called Tim's bosom? Can you look on Google Maps and find Tim's bosom? What did Abraham's bosom mean in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus? It meant Abraham's embrace. It means being embraced by Abraham. That's what it means. That's exactly what the term means. In fact, it's used, almost the same term is used in John 1:18 when it talks about Jesus being in the bosom of the Father. Is the Father's bosom a place that you can, you know, find on a star map or something? No, it means in his embrace. It means it's a loving relationship. That's what it's talking about, right? Abraham's bosom is not a place. Abraham's bosom means Abraham's embrace. As his son, he's embracing him as his son. That's why Lazarus was in Abraham's embrace. All right? Well, paradise is a place. What do you think the word, the Greek word, means? Actually, paradise is not really the word. The English word paradise is only a transliteration from the Greek. It's paradisios in Greek. And instead of, and that Greek word has a meaning. But instead of translating it as to what it actually means, the translators, instead of translating it, they transliterated it. You guys know what the difference between translating and transliterating is? If you translate it, you convey the meaning of the word into the other language. Okay, so paradisios in Greek means a lush garden. And if you translate that into English, you translate it as a garden or a park. Okay, that's what it means. But instead of translating it, our translators, instead, they simply transliterate it. What is transliterating? It means you convey the phonetic sound, what it sounds like, into another language. So paradisios is paradise if you use English letters to spell the Greek word. All right, that's what they did. They didn't translate the word for us. All the other words in this verse were Greek, and the translators translated them into English. But they didn't translate that word. All right? Now, if I do that, if I take a word, if I'm a translator and I'm translating a word from one language to another, and I'm translating something somebody is saying, and they state a word, an important word, and instead of translating it, I simply repeat the word in the same language or similar sound to what they said. What does that do for the person that's listening to me?
They won't really understand.
They won't understand it. So what it does is it cloaks the meaning of the word. And it, when you cloak the meaning of a word, you allow the statement to be easily misunderstood by the people who are hearing it. And unfortunately, this is a big problem in a lot of our English translations. I'm going to talk more about this in the next hour. Not about paradise in particular, but about how certain things have been cloaked in our translations of the Bible because they're not translated. They don't translate the word. I'll give you another example, baptizo. That's a Greek word, baptizo. What does it mean? It means to immerse something under the water. That's all it means. It's not a religious word. It's a word used in everyday speech. It means dunk. Okay? It means dunk. Baptizo in Greek means dunk. Well, why don't you find the word dunk or immersed in the Bible? Instead, they don't translate it. What do? They transliterate it. They take the sound, baptizo, and they change it to baptize. And they put that in our English Bibles. Now, the Catholic Church can take a couple little drops of water and put it on your forehead and say, you're being baptized. Or they can take a little baby and put a, you know, the sign of the cross in water on their forehead and say that that baby was baptized. But see, that baby was not baptized. Because the word baptizo in Greek means to immerse. See, it cloaks the meaning of the word. And so if the meaning of the word is cloaked, guess what happens with that term? It develops its own mythological meaning in the other language, and that's what's happened in this case. So I go back to what is paradise, paradisios, in Greek. Well, if you go in the Old Testament, back to the book of Genesis, it says God created a garden, and it was called Eden. The word garden is the same, exact same Greek word in the Greek Bible. Okay, paradisios. It means a lush, well-manicured park or garden. All right, and it's the purpose of a paradisios is so people can go out and enjoy the outdoors. That's the purpose of one, okay? But there is, throughout the Bible, we have this idea of this lush garden. Now, it's used of just like Solomon's garden or something like that as well. It's the same word. The difference is, in Genesis, it's one that God planted. And in God's paradisios, in God's paradise called Eden, there was a very important tree. The tree of life. And whoever was able to eat from the tree of life, what happened for them? Everlasting life. Eternal life, immortality. The tree of life provided immortality. And see, when the Bible is talking about the word paradise, paradisios, it's talking about the garden of God. It's talking about the fact that the tree of life, those in the garden of God, have access to the tree of life. All right? Now, when the Bible talks in the Old Testament about the kingdom, when the kingdom is going to be restored, when after Christ returns, the desert is going to blossom as a rose and all that. It uses the same word, paradisios, for the kingdom. That is the restored area around Israel where we're going to have an inheritance and all that. The Bible talks about that, right? It uses the very same word there. If you look at your paper, under number 5, Roman numeral 5, paradise, it says the Garden of Eden is paradise there. In LXX is the Greek Old Testament, Septuagint. And then I have one verse, Genesis 2:9. There are lots and lots of verses that refer to Eden as paradisios in the Old Testament. It's not just this one. This is just an example. But you get the sense. And God made to spring up also out of the earth every tree beautiful to the eye and good for food, and the tree of life in the midst of the paradise or paradisios, and the tree of learning, the knowledge of good and evil. Now, as I said, in the kingdom, the garden of God is going to be restored. That is, the earth is going to be turned back into the garden of God. Now, I'm not saying the entire earth. All right? Where was Eden located? Does anybody know? In the Middle East. It tells us where the rivers were that came out from the water that was flowing out of it, and one of them was the Nile, and one of them was the Euphrates. So if you look at those, there was actually four rivers, but if you look at where those rivers are, the central location of that is really the Middle East, the land of Israel. All right, and probably the surrounding area. It would include Syria and Jordan and maybe part of Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's much bigger than just the nation of Israel, but it'd be a large area there in the Middle East on the eastern side of the Mediterranean Sea. All right, that's where the Garden of Eden was, and that's where the Tree of Life was. Okay, now most of it's desert, but all that is going to be restored when Isaiah says that, you know, when Christ returns, the desert's going to blossom like a rose. He said he's going to cause springs to come up in the desert, and all the land's going to be healed and all that. Isaiah talks about that over and over again. Well, in Isaiah 51:3, and this is, again, from the Greek version of the Bible, because we're looking at a Greek word, so we have to look at the Greek version of the Old Testament. It says in Isaiah 51:3, "And now I will comfort thee, O Zion. I have comforted all her desert places, and I will make her desert places as paradise," or paradisios, "and her western places as the paradise of the Lord." Now, the reason it specifies paradise of the Lord is because the only paradise of the Lord in the Bible is Eden. It's the one God planted. See? God planted it, and God put the tree there. And so what it's implying by using the expression the paradise of the Lord is that it's going to have the Tree of Life. That's what's implying. All right? They shall find in it gladness and exaltation, thanksgiving, and the voice of praise. Now, did the thief know about that verse right there? Isaiah 51:3. He was a Jew. And little Jewish boys, before they have their bar mitzvah, they have to learn a lot of Old Testament scriptures. Okay? He might not have memorized it, but he was certainly familiar with it. All right? Referring to the kingdom as the paradise of God. Now, does the New Testament use that kind of terminology as well? What is our destination as the people of God?
The kingdom.
But another term for that is paradisios. The kingdom is paradise because it's the creation restored with the Tree of Life and all that again. And how do we know that? Look at Revelation 2:7. You don't have to turn there. It's on your paper. By the way, what I have right there, if you walk in the front door, you walk right past it. It's on the wall. Did you see it? There's a tree, a metal tree on the wall, and under it are these words. "To him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God." Paradisios, same term. All right? So, what is paradise? Well, you can say it's one of two things. It was the Garden of Eden, or it's in the kingdom when God restores the Garden of Eden, basically, because that's what he's going to do in the kingdom. He's restoring the Garden of Eden, and he's going to allow us to eat of the Tree of Life. And notice, this Revelation 2:7 is talking about those who overcome or those who conquer. That is, he's talking to Christians. If you persevere in your faith, if you persevere in following me, and you follow me all the way, here's your destination. That's what Jesus was saying in Revelation. What is your destination? Paradise, which has the Tree of Life. He's going to let you eat off the Tree of Life, which is in paradise. Okay? Now, is paradise some mystical place where ghosts go? That's not here on the surface of the earth. It's nowhere else in the Bible is it ever that. So why would Jesus all of a sudden have a completely mystical Greek philosophical idea and associate the word paradise to it when even the Greeks didn't even do that? Why would we do that? Why would we? See, if you understand what paradise is according to the Bible, there's no question that in this context, what Jesus was saying to the thief is, you're going to be with me in the kingdom and you're going to be able to eat from the Tree of Life. That's what he was saying. Or you're going to be in the garden, which is how it should be literally translated. Does that make sense to you guys?
Yes.
All right. So, logically, let me ask you this. These two interpretations that I've given you here, all right, this is the one in the New King James Version. This is my translation. I'm not the only one who translates it that way, by the way. There's other translations that do. In which one of these did Jesus answer the thief's question? And in which one did he ignore his question and give him something entirely different that wasn't ever even related to his question? Look at it. Look at the first one. What did the thief ask him? What was the thief concerned about? When he goes into the kingdom, right? Into the kingdom. And what did Jesus say? Forget about the kingdom, thief. You're going to be with me in some ghost lounge somewhere, some mystical place. Your ghost is going to fly away with me. Had nothing to do with what the thief asked. Nothing whatsoever to do with what the thief asked. However, if you translate it this way, then Jesus answered his question directly, because the garden is synonymous with the kingdom. You see that? He asks him about the kingdom, and when he comes into his kingdom, he didn't ask him about anything that's going to happen between now and, you know, thousands of years from now when your kingdom comes. I want to know what's going to happen in between there. Did he ask him about that? No. He only asked him about his kingdom. And Jesus' answer was directly related to his question. That is, he answered his question, right? So, Lord, remember when you're coming to your kingdom? And Jesus said, I'm telling you today, right now, I'm telling you, even before you die, you're going to be with me in the garden. That is in the kingdom. See, it's a direct answer to the question. All right? So, here's the bottom line. According to the grammar, if you're just looking at the grammar and you have no other considerations, if you're not concerned with Jesus' style of speaking, if you're not concerned with your own presuppositions, that is, whether you believe or not, whether people, you know, continue to live on as ghosts after they die and fly away somewhere, if you take those things off the table and you just look at the grammar, there's no way to determine which way it could be translated. Either way is perfectly legitimate in Greek grammar, okay? And the grammar doesn't favor either one. They're both perfectly legitimate. There's no rules that would require you to attach it to the phrase before it or to attach it to the phrase afterward. There are no rules of Greek grammar that would solve that problem for you. So then the determination comes down to a couple of things. What was Jesus' normal style of speaking? And we found other examples, right? Whenever he wanted to put the word today in the second part, that is, instead of saying that I'm telling you this and put it in the part where he's actually quoting what he wants to say, he uses the word hati or that in order to introduce it. When he doesn't do that, and we only have one case of him not doing it, the implication is it's different. Therefore, most likely, it goes the other way. Okay? That's an inference. It's not proof. All right? It's evidence. So we have that. Then we have the logical aspects of it as far as would him attaching it to either phrase add something of significance to the thief either way. And in that case, it makes much better sense that he's telling the thief that he's passing his judgment today as opposed to him having to wait until the resurrection or until the judgment. All right, it makes better sense. And then finally, in my opinion, the word paradise completely solves the problem entirely, because paradise is not a mystical place somewhere that's not here on the surface of the earth, that's not physical, where people's ghosts go to await the resurrection. There is no such concept in the Bible. The word paradise is never used that way anywhere else in the Bible. And to come to this passage and insist that that's what it means here is contrary to everywhere else that it appears in the Bible. All right? So what I'm telling you is all the evidence, in my opinion, weighs heavily in favor of the translation that I have given you and against the way it's translated in the New King James and in most English translations. And the reason it's translated that way is because the translators all come from a theological way of thinking that includes the idea that a man is a ghost living in a flesh suit, and when he dies, his ghost is going to fly away somewhere. They're coming to the text already believing that. And that's why they don't bother to research what paradise means. They don't bother to look at all these other things. And they just translate it that way because it's consistent with what they already believe. And unfortunately, and I know this is very disconcerting to people to tell them that There's a lot of translator bias in our English translators, but it's absolutely true. And the more I study the Bible, the more I see it. All right? It's important that we dig in and find out the source of the weeds that are in the English versions of the Bible. That if you were to read the Bible in Greek, they're not there at all. See, if you were to read the Bible in Greek and read this passage in Greek, there's nothing there at all that would lead you to believe that Jesus was saying that he would be in paradise that day. There's nothing there at all. It's only there when we read our English translations of it. And it's only in our English translations because the people making the translations already believe that. And so when they have to decide, they got to put the comma somewhere. See, there has to be a comma. And they have to decide, do I put it before or after? If I put it before or after, I'm entirely changing the meaning of the passage. Entirely. And so their decision comes down to what they believe is theologically true. And it's their beliefs that drive their translation. And that's, unfortunately, that happens a lot in the scriptures. This is one of the worst examples of it, but there are plenty of examples of it. Yeah, Walter.
If you think about it, if they had translated the word, put guard instead, that totally refutes what they believe.
It does, because the garden is clearly a physical place here on earth. It's not some mystical place somewhere else. So, again. But again, see, they come to the text believing that there is a, quote, paradise for souls. Just like they come believing that the ultimate reward of the righteous is to live in heaven forever. Most of the translators believe that. And so when they're translating the text, if there are ambiguities in the text, they have to make choices. They have to make decisions. See, the work of translation is not just a word for word, fact for fact, and here are all the rules, and you follow all the rules, and my translation is always going to come out the same way. That's not how translating works. There, you have to understand the concepts that are being stated in order to translate correctly. You have to understand what the person is saying. That's the point I'm trying to say. You have to understand what the person means and what they're saying before you can translate it correctly. All right? Yes. Well, that's the point. See, at the beginning we talked about the rules that we were going to use in this class for interpreting the scripture. And one of the things that we talked about was this historical approach, right? And that is, we want to put ourselves in the place of the person who was being spoken to. We know who spoke it. Jesus did. We know the situation. They're hanging on the cross. They're dying. And we know that the thief is desperate. He's absolutely desperate. He knows he's guilty, he knows he's dying, and he knows he's going to face Jesus, the judge, at the last judgment. And he knows it's not looking good for him. See, when we interpret the passage with all those factors in mind, it's not that hard to figure out what was going on. And it's not hard to figure out where the comma belongs. All right? Does that make sense to you guys? All right. So if you want to, there's nothing sacred about your printed English translation. If you want to cross out the comma and move it, hey, it was just a man who put it there. Okay? It was just a guy who put it there. So if you're just a guy or a gal, you can put it somewhere else, all right? If you have proper reason to believe it goes somewhere else. And I gave you the reasons. So I would advise you to scratch it out and move it. There are no commas in the original language. All right? Just like there are no verse numbers, and there are no chapter divisions. And very often, chapter divisions are in the wrong place. They actually put a chapter division right in the middle of a thought, which makes it look like entirely different thought. That happens too, but that's translators. That's what they do. I mean, I'm not trying to denounce translators. They do a wonderful job 99% of the time. But it's those little occasions where they allow their own presuppositions to override what the text is actually saying that they can plant little weeds in the text that will give cover to false doctrine. That is, you won't be able to detect false doctrine because of the way they translated a particular passage. All right? Everybody get that? Any questions?
Is there any punctuation?
Well, there is today, but not when the Bible was written. No, no punctuation at all. In fact, you have to determine from the context when a sentence starts and ends.
So what back then?
Let me add one more thing. There were no spaces between words. All the letters were jammed together. There were no spaces. And on a few rare occasions, where you cut the word makes all the difference in the world. All right? Because the last letter may not belong to this word, it belongs to that word. It's rare, but there are a few occasions where that actually makes a difference. So, if you were to see the original Greek text or the early copies of the original Greek text, it was in all capital letters, and all the letters were jammed together with no spaces in between. And even at the end, you know, when they would write it out, line after line on the manuscript, they even broke words in two sometimes. In other words, half the word would be on the top line and the rest of it would be on the bottom line. And there's no dash like there is in English. So unless you know what that word is, you wouldn't know that they broke the sentence or broke it up to go to the next line. So you have to understand what they're saying in order to properly translate the text. All right.
It has to be a scary thing when you're reading that and changing little things in there because to think that you may be changing something, you have to really study to make sure you're right.
You do, and it should be, if you do it, it should be done fearfully. But here's the thing, I do, because you don't have the benefit of knowing the Greek grammar like I do.
Right.
Okay? I've studied Greek grammar for quite a few years. You're trusting me with regard to this. But listen, you don't have to trust me entirely. You can go and educate yourselves without a whole lot of work, just on some basics of Greek grammar. You can educate yourself online. You can sit in your bedroom. If you really want to know and you're really concerned, you can actually, educate yourselves. There are places where you can actually learn Greek online. Okay? So you don't have to trust me entirely. Well, you'll have to trust me entirely then, Thelma, or else. But keep in mind, I'm not altering the Greek text. See, the New Testament was written in Greek. I'm not changing anything at all in the Greek text. Not one iota am I changing in the Greek text. What I'm changing is an English translation that was made by a man. Okay? The English translation has the authority. It has a level of authority from God, yes, because he wrote the original. But that is not, the translation itself is not absolutely authoritative because it has gone through the filter of a man's mind, and then he translated it into another language as best he understood it, and as best as he understood the rules of the different languages. All right? And look, I think the vast majority of Bible translators have done a phenomenal job. Okay? They've done a phenomenal job. But the fly in the ointment is these preconceived theological ideas that many of them have originated in the Roman Catholic Church and have simply been assumed to be true down through the centuries of Christianity. And when the Protestant churches broke off from Catholicism, they kept hanging on to these same concepts, these same ideas. And so when they read the Bible, they read their ideas into the Bible instead of allowing the Bible to speak for itself. What we're trying to do is pull those weeds. We're trying to get those places where the text is vague and see if maybe it could be understood a different way. And if we look at the Bible with a different set of presuppositions, it says something entirely different than if you look at it with those presuppositions. See? So what I'm doing is, I'm doing the same thing the translators do. All right, now I want you to be aware of this. I'm no better than they are. In fact, most of them have much more skill than I do. But the difference is, I'm approaching the Bible with a different set of presuppositions, okay? That I've learned from 35 years of studying the Bible in detail. And understanding what the Bible is saying and the concepts of the Bible. So when I look at the Bible and I look at this verse, I don't look at it as though believing that people have ghosts that go someplace when they die to wait for the resurrection. I don't believe that because I can't find it in the Bible. And you can't prove it from a verse that can be taken two different ways. You can't prove anything from that. See? So what I'm going to do is when I look at the text, I'm going to put the comma where is perfectly legitimate for it to go, according to grammar, which is seems to be consistent with Jesus' pattern of usage, and which answers the question as to why the word's there in the first place, and is consistent with the Bible's definition of what paradise is. See, all those things weigh in favor of the way that I translated it and against the way that others have translated it, or at least the New King James has translated it. Okay? So what I'm doing is I'm not telling you it must be this way and you must believe it because I say so. What I'm telling you is here are the reasons why I believe it should be translated this way and not that way. And you can make up your own decision. All right? All I'm doing is telling you why I believe that this translation is accurate and this one is not. If you think my arguments are valid and that they're weighty and that they're even conclusive, then I would recommend that you move the comma in your Bible. If you think there's still a question mark and I haven't convinced you that those arguments are legitimate, then I suggest you get out your Bible, you do a word study of the word paradise. Okay? That you check these things out. Find out what the Bible says about these things. And then make your own decision. All right? I never dictate here what you should believe. I don't know if you know that or not. If you've been coming here a while, you know I don't. What I try to do is tell you why I believe the Bible says what it says. And I try to give you my thinking process as to why I come to that conclusion. All right? But everybody here is free to interpret the text any way they think is right. Everybody has to make their choice. We all have a free will. And nobody says you have to, believe this or that in order to come here or anything like that. I'm simply trying to educate you. That's all I'm trying to do is educate you. All right? And raise your awareness of things like translator bias and things like that that show up from time to time. All right? Okay, if there are no questions, we'll be done. If there are questions, I'll try to answer it. None. We're done.